Hi, this is Jovi.
And this is Charlie.
And you're listening to
Bed Crime Stories. This is a weekly true crime podcast where we pour ourselves a drink and we take turns telling each other the stories that keep us up at night. And now, part two of a very special Charlie's Cult Corner.
Welcome back, everybody.
Welcome back, everybody.
Yes, welcome back. And before we do start part two, why don't we do a quick recap? Like, what was the last thing that we talked about?
Okay, that's a great idea.
Yes.
That's a great idea, Jovi.
Thank you. Thank you.
Man, you should do this professionally.
You know?
So where we last left off, Jim Jones had returned from Brazil back to Indiana because the People's Temple was in financial collapse. Drumming the beat of impending nuclear war, tells the People's Temple that it is time to leave Indiana and move to Northern California, where they will be at the forefront of this impending Eden for the new socialist movement once this nuclear war is over. And we are at the point now where Jim Jones truly starts to take shape as, I mean, really, a cult leader. He is officially getting to the point where he has influenced people enough to move them out of the home that they've known. Right. Yep. So this is where shit starts to really get real.
It's like he had his appetizer and now he's ready for his meal.
He had his amuse-bouche, and yes. Now that his bouche is amused, it is time to move on to the main course.
Yes, and I think it's also pretty safe to say that he will be getting no more checks in his pro column.
I think that is a really fucking safe bet that you just made there, Jovi.
Perfect. Let's add to that con column. Let's do it.
We're just gonna, it's really all cons from here on out.
Yes, yes.
Like a story full of cons. So, all right, let's jump in. Oh, my nose is so itchy. I don't know if you've been able, like, if you've noticed, my nose is so itchy. And this happens if I talk for a really long time. So just real quick, guys, before we get into the story. As many of you might know, I may have brought it up before, like, my career is corporate trainer, right? My name is Barbie and my job is corporate trainer. And, it's actually a really bad thing that when I talk for a long time, my nose gets itchy because, like, my job is to talk for a long time. And I think it's partially because I'm a slightly a nasally person. Like, my voice is slightly nasally.
Mm-hmm. So you got that vibration.
Vibrates. And yeah. I have a large nose. Boop. I have a very big nose. And I think because my nose is large, so it's like 98% cartilage, floppy. When I speak, it vibrates. Vibrate equals tickly, itchy, equals constant itchy nose.
Yep. And I mean, at least, you know, it's not like my cousin's big nose that when he talks, it goes down.
I will tell you. Okay. So, like, again, I'm sorry. We can keep all of this in because my large nose is entertaining.
And it's Thanksgiving. Like so we have to make it fun a little
my
bit.
My turkey nose. We'll talk about my beak. So it's a fact that your nose never stops growing, right? And when people get older, their nose does get, like, longer. I feel like my nose is getting longer because I'm going to turn to the side. Jovi, you tell me if I'm wrong. I feel like it's starting to do the dip down, and it never dipped as far down as it is now. Ready?
Like a
ready?
Witch's nose. Oh, yeah. Look at that.
Dipping down. What the fuck? Why is it doing it? I hate it.
I would never have noticed it until you were like, look at my nose
pointing
to the ground.
It's different than it used to be.
It is different than it used to be.
I know. Yeah. I hate it. I hate it. The other day, I was scrolling through TikTok and this girl had a nose that looked legit just like mine.
Yeah.
And all the comments, oh my God, that is a beautiful Roman nose. Because I'm Italian, so Italian, I have, like, a guinea nose, right? Oh, I'm sorry. Is that? Well, I'm saying it. I'm that person. So it's like a big Italian nose.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, that is a beautiful Roman nose. I'm like, first of all, not one person in my life has ever referred to it as something as lovely as a Roman nose.
Right.
anybody ever once called it like a Roman nose, I'd be like, nope. Fuck yeah, it's a Roman nose. No. It's always been, hey, check out that honker on that bitch over there. It's a large nose. People also used to manipulate my last name to change it into having the word nose in it.
Yep. I remember that.
Very unfortunate for me that my name slightly rhymes with nose.
Yes. It's
really shitty.
Yes.
Not pleasant. So now as I notice that the tip is starting to get like turned down and longer, I am so self-conscious of it.
So, wow.
I hate it.
Maybe you could try where like at night you put a piece of tape on it and tape it up to see if you could curve it up and like change the course of the way it's growing. If
my luck will get like a dent in the middle of it, it'll be like bent all the way up. And I promised my uncle that I would never get my nose done because he and I have the same exact nose. And he always made me promise that I would never get a nose job. Mm-hmm. I can't break my promise. I love my uncle. I will never do it. But OMG, this friggin' honker is big. And getting bigger by the minute.
Well, when it starts wiggling when you talk, then we might have a bigger concern there.
I hate it
because
so
that's
much.
Strange.
I hate it so much. Okay, let's get back into Jonestown. Oh lordy. Okay, we are now in 1964.
Okay.
1964. Jones starts to make trips out to California because he is looking for the best place to relocate the People's Temple. Mm-hmm. In July 1965, he and his followers start to move out there because he has found a property in the Redwood Valley near the city of Ukiah, which again is
Redwood
a guess.
Redwood Forest.
To the Gulfstream waters. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Correct. So, a gentleman named Russell Winberg, he was the assistant pastor at the People's Temple. He was not a fan of moving the congregation. He started to actually speak against Jim Jones. Ooh. And he would warn members that he believed Jim Jones was abandoning Christianity, which of course, technically was the foundation of the beliefs. Mm-hmm. So Russell Winberg takes over leadership at the Indianapolis church when Jones leaves to go to California.
Okay.
About 140 of Jones's most loyal followers went to California.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's a decent amount of people too.
It's a pretty big clip of people that were that committed to him to move across country and go to California.
Yeah. Like to uproot their entire lives.
Mm-hmm.
Oof.
Mm-hmm. The rest stay back with Winberg. In the first couple of months, Jones is already out recruiting. He recruits 50 members of the People's Temple within the first couple of months he's out there. In 1967, he was able to get another 75 members of the Indianapolis chapter to move to California.
Jesus.
In 1968, the California location was admitted. Now this chapter was admitted to the Disciples of Christ denomination. So the Indiana chapter was already admitted. Now California is as well. And he begins to use this connection to promote the People's Temple. And he wants to kind of promote the temple as part of the larger members of the full denomination. There's like 1.5 million people who are part of the Disciples of Christ. And he's like, well, this is part of it. So come over here instead, type of a thing.
Right.
He played up the fact that there was very famous members of the Disciples of Christ, including Lyndon B. Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover.
Hmm.
So incredibly influential American political figures. How much do you want to be part of their congregation? Right.
Right.
But of course, he completely is lying and misrepresenting what the People's Temple does versus what the Disciples of Christ truly is.
Well, of course, that's the only way that he could get people to join them.
Is to lie.
Yes.
But by 1969, he has increased the membership of the People's Temple in California to 300. So he started with 140. He has now more than doubled it. Now it's the early 1970s. He starts to denounce Christianity.
Mm.
Which, again, kind of going back to Mr. Winberg over in Indianapolis, kind of what he was saying all along, of like, he's not like sticking with the foundation of what we were trying to do here.
Right.
He called Christianity, quote, a flyaway religion.
Oh, shit.
He rejected the Bible and said that the Bible was simply a tool used to oppress women and non-whites. Jones referred to the traditional Christian view of God as, quote, sky God. I'm sorry.
Sky God?
I don't know. It's kind of funny. Who was no God at all.
Oh, because he lived in heaven.
Sky God,
in heaven.
Sky God is no God at all. And instead, Jones himself claimed to be God and said that there was no other God beside him.
Oh, look, another cult.
Cult characteristic. I think yep. number three we're on.
I think we're on three. Four. Yeah.
Three. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. technically, if you think about it, it could be four because those people uprooted and followed him. It's kind of disconnecting them from their
families.
Their families.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. So
I think we're on four.
I think four. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he starts to really promote this idea that he is divine, that he is God. He goes so far as to tell his congregation, quote, I am come as God socialist. So like sky God, God socialist.
Wow.
There. Okay.
Wow. Wow.
But he, of course, now he starts to gain influence in California. Okay. Mm-hmm. In like the political scene in California. And he's very careful to make sure that his claims of divinity stay within the church and does not go out.
Okay.
So he's incredibly careful about claiming his divinity beyond the congregation, but he expected to be treated godlike by the followers.
Uh-huh.
Former temple member, a man named Hugh Fortston Jr. quotes him as saying, quote, what you need to believe in is what you can see. If you see me as your friend, I'll be your friend. If you see me as your father, I'll be your father. For those of you that don't have a father, if you see me as your savior, I'll be your savior. If you see me as your God, I'll be your God.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yick.
End quote. Oh, boy.
Yick. He didn't say yick. I said yick.
Yes.
Okay. He's continuing to preach the fact that this apocalypse nuclear war is coming. And he's now added to it that it is not only a nuclear war, it is a nuclear race war.
Stop it.
Yes. And that the Nazis are going to come and the white supremacists are going to come and they're going to put people of color into concentration camps all over the world.
Oh, my God. This guy,
you know, and that he himself was the Messiah who's going to lead them to salvation and save people.
Okay. All right.
Exactly. I know. And of course, by doing so, claims that the only way that they're going to be able to escape the reality of this nuclear race war is to follow him and believe in his teachings. And that once the apocalypse was over, they're going to emerge to establish the perfect communist society, which, cult sidebar, is very reminiscent of Charles Manson. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what Charles Manson did with the family.
Yep.
He moved them to the desert. He was going to say that we're going to go in like a hole. There's going to be the race wars. And when we emerge, we're going to help to create the new perfect society.
Yep.
Like, guys.
Come on. Like, OMG. Fucking come on.
Stop sharing the same how to do book. Okay.
Legit. Like, we're starting to catch on, you know, like.
But are we?
I mean,
this cult still exists. So are we?
Yes. But the thing of it is that strong-minded people could see it. You know what I mean?
I agree with you to a point.
Yeah.
I agree with you to a point. Have you ever seen the documentary on HBO that's about the Heaven's Gate cult?
Yes.
Okay. That documentary did a really great job of dissecting like the psychology behind the follower of a cult,
mm-hmm.
and how like you don't have to be lost or weak-minded to fall for it. They just have to be selling exactly what you need. And like you see that like with Nexium, right? When Nexium was established, it was, this is a self-help seminar and yay women. And then next thing you know, these women are being branded with the initials of their cult leader.
Yeah.
And forced into like sex slavery.
Yes.
And it's little bits at a time. Then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, you've bought it hook, line, and sinker, and you're in.
Yes. But at the same time, I feel like, yeah, you buy into it, but then you could also realize it. That's why people leave. You know what I mean?
Correct.
There are people that realize it eventually. I mean, and it sucks.
And
that
it
they
only
had
takes
to go
like
through.
One thing.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. And I'm sure by the time they realize it, as you know, watching the NXIVM special, that they went through so much, but they finally realized it, got out, and were trying to educate those that were still within the cult.
Yes.
And it didn't happen.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And you see that a lot with Scientology, with people who
Correct.
Defect from Scientology. All of a sudden, like, the light turns on and you're like, oh shit.
Correct.
And like, these are smart, accomplished individuals that are all of a sudden like, oh my God, like, what the hell did I just do with my life?
Yep.
You know, in How I Met Your Mother, the episode of How I Met Your Mother, where they're talking about the person's like thing that they do that they don't realize they do that's annoying.
Yes.
Like Marshall sings whatever he's doing.
Yes.
Which, again, relatable. And once the person realizes it's what they do, like the glass shatters and like the spell's broken. That's how I feel about that, right? Like, it's
correct.
That one thing that that person who follows Jim Jones sees, that all of a sudden like the glass breaks and they're like, wait a minute. Mm-hmm.
What?
Sky God versus socialist God? I'm sorry, what? Like,
right.
It's like, it's that one thing that just doesn't make sense or jive
Correct.
with them.
Or
That's
it makes
all
you
that you
second
need.
guess what you heard or what you've
Correct.
seen or what you've been doing.
Right.
And it's just
which is why, like, when a family member or a person who's outside of this, the community tries to pull a person out, they're not going to believe, they have to see it for themselves.
Oh yeah.
It's not that simple.
No.
Mm-mm. And that's why it takes like years of deprogramming to get all of that stuff that you have been like brainwashed out of your system.
Yeah.
And that's why cults are fucking fascinating.
Yes.
To me.
Yes.
I fucking love them. Okay.
Yes. And
I don't
you know
love
what?
Them, but I love them.
Like,
the psychology of it is just fucking insane.
Agreed. And I am a sucker for cult survivor stories. I could listen to them all day long.
Same.
All
that
day
is
long.
Why I was like obsessed with that freaking Leah Remini show.
Yes.
The amount of times
Yes.
that I've watched that show, it's the same stories over and over again.
Yes.
I'm watching the same things over and over again. I am obsessed. I watch it all the time.
But it's
so
fascinating.
Good.
And like,
yes,
the Stay Sweet,
oh,
like that whole thing.
Yep.
And even NXIVM, it's just like, holy shit. And
well,
to
you know
hear
what
it
I'm
from them and just the shit that they went through. And oh my God.
And now, not a documentary, but I'm actually rewatching the Andrew Garfield one about the story that I did probably like a year ago now with the murder in the LDS church.
Yes.
Like, it's that same thing of like, you're watching this family deteriorate because they're buying into these ideas that just are so out of what they've ever been taught and what they've ever believed. And then, you know, you see the cop who, and of course, like, dramatized for our pleasure, you see the cop who is in the LDS start to doubt and be like, well, what do you mean that's part of our history? We were never taught that. You know, it's so corrupt and whatever. It's just, it's crazy. When that glass breaks, I want to hear everything from you. Like, I want to know your whole story.
I
what
want to help you
happened?
Pick up those pieces of glass that broke. And I want to help you put your life together.
Yes.
Like, that's, I do. I
and I will listen
do.
To you for days.
Yes.
Tell me everything.
Every
and I want to help you and understand.
Thing.
Yes.
Yep. Agreed.
Yep.
Sorry.
Okay.
I didn't mean to sidebar you.
No.
I did not. I'm sorry.
Good sidebar. good sidebar. Okay.
Thank you.
Now, we know, right, there's abuse within the People's Temple. And the first known cases of abuse really started to kind of come to light, or first serious cases of abuse really started to come to light in California. The kind of the leaders of the church, Jim Jones called them the Planning Commission. So they were like I want to say the elders, because that's not correct. They were just the guys who were like his inner sanctum, if you will.
Okay.
And as the planning committee started to discipline members that weren't following Jones's rules and his prophecies or what have you, they started to punish them. His control over the members of the People's Temple, of course, also extended into their sex lives. I mentioned that last episode. Mm-hmm. Who could get married? Who could have sex with who? Members were forced to get abortions. He himself started to ask sexual favors from wives of other members. It was a power thing, not only over the women, but also over the husbands of the wives that he was having sex with. And he even raped several male members of his congregation.
Oh, shit.
Now, what was one of those asterisks that I asked you to remember from last episode?
The only heterosexual male.
Yes, that Jim Jones was the only heterosexual male on the planet. Now, mm-hmm. now, I'm not inferring anything by this whatsoever, that I do not know if Jim Jones was a gay man. I do not think he was a gay man. I'm not saying he was a closeted gay man. All I'm saying, he's a fucking abuser, right? Mm-hmm. However, if you are the most heterosexual person on the planet, I am air quoting like a lunatic over here. Mm-hmm. If you're the most, right, you're more than likely not going to rape people of the same sex.
No, I'm going to say you're correct on that.
Now, I know it's about power. It's not about like the act. It's about mm-hmm. power. But at the same time, I would also, in my unofficial position, and my opinion, mm-hmm. I think that those two things are diametrically opposed. Let's say.
I agree. I could, you know what? I concur with that.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jerry. Okay. Members also started to rebel against the control that Jones started to take over their food intake, the way that they worked. He would ridicule them. He would publicly humiliate them in front of the rest of the congregation. He would sometimes resort to physical violence in front of the rest of the congregation. And as the membership grew, he actually started to create an armed security group that would help to keep people in line and make sure that they are maintaining order. And it would also, of course, act as security for himself.
Yeah.
Again,
so now we're pretty much outlining every single cult red flag.
Yeah, and every like single most leaders of a church organization don't have like armed guards.
No.
In around their church. I mean, like honestly, I would say that the exception to the rule is the Pope. However, yeah, I actually don't even think I don't think that the Swiss guards carry weapons though. I will have to look that up. I don't know. Swiss guards, yeah, that I don't know. But like, even if they do, I honestly, not to say that they're not protecting the Pope, like I think they are, but like, I think more than protecting the Pope, they're protecting the like gajillions and priceless artifacts, art and gold and jewels that just like hang out at the Vatican any
correct
day, you know?
Correct.
I'm just saying.
I agree.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Like I said, not like I think that they wouldn't like try to protect the Pope, like mm-hmm. jump in front of him or anything, but I think I might have a little more jewels than the person.
But two, you have to figure that they know that the Pope is in the Pope Mobile and it has bulletproof glass. So
yes, there's been assassination attempts on the Pope before.
Yep.
Hence why the Pope Mobile even exists.
Yep.
It always reminds me of, and I think there's like a meme about it too. The Pope Mobile always reminds me of like Trouble. Remember the game Trouble? Where like you would press the dome and the dice would flow. Boop. Pop the Pope, you know?
Yep, pop the Pope.
Yeah, that's sacrilegious. As if I wasn't going to hell already. Okay. By 1970, the temple has several branches in several cities. So they're in San Fernando, they're in San Francisco, they're in LA, they're still up in Ukiah, they're back in Indianapolis. They're kind of all over the place. The fingers of the People's Temple are starting to expand across the U.S. And he starts to really focus on like the major cities because he knows that's where he's going to gain the most influence and the most people. He eventually moves the headquarters to San Francisco, which at that point, right, we're talking the 70s, San Francisco, this is flower power, lots of radical movements happening in San Francisco at the time. So he knows that he will, or he thinks that he will have a standing within the political movement in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And by 1973, the People's Temple reaches 2,570 members, and they have about 36,000 subscribers to their fundraising newsletter.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So news is spreading about the People's Temple.
Yeah.
Beginning of the 70s, he starts to get some negative press. In October 1971, reporters cover one of his healing services at the old church in Indiana. And the news report was like, he's a quack. This is fake. This person wasn't really sick in the first place. They're not healed. They challenged him to give tissue samples of the material they claimed fell off the person who he healed from cancer. Again,
oh, air quotes.
So like, oh yeah, that tumor fell off. Let's go ahead and take that and test it and prove to you that it's not actually cancer. It's probably like a thing of silly putty, right? The investigations really started to cause a lot of alarm with the people who are loyalists to one Mr. Jim Jones. He was starting to get even more fearful now that this stuff, all of this news attention, the publicity is going to expose the falsities of the church. So of course he says, you know what? No more Indiana. It's too far from California. So that is its own thing. If you guys want to keep it going, that's your prerogative. That is not considered part of People's Temple. We're only focusing on California.
Oh, shit. And
I mean, truly the point of that was for him to kind of like take the heat off of what happened in Indiana and the fact that that's where the news had come out about this healing session that he did.
Yeah.
But the issue only starts to escalate, and a series of articles targeting the People's Temple and specifically Jim Jones starts to run in the San Francisco Examiner in September of 1972. Once again, they are saying that these healing rituals, these miracles that he's supposedly performing are a hoax, that he obviously, that he is not divine in any way. And they're really starting to put him on front street, put him on blast. In 1973, a man named Ross Case, he was a former follower of Jim Jones. He starts to work with a group in Ukiah to investigate the People's Temple. They uncover a healing ritual that was staged. They also uncover abusive treatment of a woman who left the church. They also uncover evidence that Jim Jones did, in fact, rape a male member of the congregation. Reports of a former member being involved in this investigation against him finally reach Jim Jones, and he starts to like completely fucking
lose his shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's spiraling now. He's paranoid that the authorities are going to come because now that there's this person who was once a follower kind of spilling all the beans, you know? Case reports his findings to local police, but they didn't do anything.
What? Were there members that were part of the local police?
I have no idea.
That is fucking crazy. Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
Even though the police didn't do anything, Jones is still like, we gotta get the fuck out of here. Because it's getting real. The sharks are circling. They know that I'm starting to lose control, basically. And he decides that it's time again to relocate the People's Temple. But before he could leave, on December 13th, 1973, Jones is arrested. He's charged with lewd conduct for allegedly masturbating in the presence of a male undercover LAPD vice officer in a movie theater restroom near LA's MacArthur Park.
Stop it.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. He pulled a Pee Wee Herman.
Yes, he did. Yes.
May Pee Wee rest in peace.
Yes.
Which, of course, you know, hey. And also, like, to give Pee Wee Herman his, like, prop. He was in a porn theater. What are you supposed to do?
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
That's stupid. But anyway. I don't think that Jim Jones was. I think he was just, like, going to Happy Town in the bathroom.
Holy shit.
But on December 20th of 73, the charge was dismissed. And the court file was sealed. And eventually the arrest records were destroyed.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No.
So Okay, not only do they not do anything when they get these reports of all this abuse and whatnot, and then this happens, the record sealed and then destroyed. Huh. That sounds kind of sus.
Yes, Gen Z Jovi, it does sound sus. That's wacky. Oh, no, that's not even real. That's
No.
like 80s shit. I don't know.
Yes.
I
That's like
that's
90s, but yeah. Wickedy whack.
it's whack. I don't even know. I can't even think of anything else to
No,
say.
me neither.
That's cap. No, that's wrong. I think that's
No,
wrong. No
no,
cap.
no cap.
No cap.
No.
I don't remember. I don't fucking
I don't
know.
know. Let's not. I don't, I
Yeah.
never understood that cap, no cap bullshit. It's like,
Yeah.
what?
Because it doesn't make sense. It's like
It
opposite
doesn't.
day. So like cap means lying. No cap means real.
Yeah.
Which you would think it would be the opposite. Like cap would be real.
Correct.
Like you put it like cap, it's correct. But no cap. No, it's flippy flopped.
Oh.
Facts. All facts, no printer. That's like a thing too. The
Oh.
other one that I don't understand is Delulu.
Delusional?
Yeah. But
Yeah.
no, I don't like don't get why Delulu. It's takes the exact same amount of time to say it.
I know. I know. I think it's
Yeah.
just because it's a fun way of saying it.
I guess. The one that I saw the other day was like, the Delulu came true Lulu or something like that. I'm like, I hate you all. Stop it. True Lulu. I don't know. Whatever. It was funny. It was funny written out, and now I'm just ashamed that I said it out loud. Okay. Good God. Okay. So it's the fall of 1973. Jim Jones and the Planning Commission are like, it is time. It's
Is
time to
time.
go. We got to get the fuck out of here because it is like impending that there's going to be a raid on the People's Temple. And I don't think he's wrong on that.
Yeah.
So they start to come up with a long-term plan to get them out of the United States.
And run away from their
And
problems.
kind of, yeah. And they decide Guyana is the place to go. So there was a recent revolution in Guyana. The government of Guyana is a socialist government, so kind of in line with their teachings and beliefs. And we remember that when he was there in the early 60s, they like ate
Loved
Jones
him.
up with a spoon. They loved him. So they decide in October, they vote unanimously, it is time to go to Guyana. And they present it as it's going to be an agricultural commune. So they're going to go, they're going to farm, they're going to live off the land. It's going to be a true socialist group living community.
Sure.
In December of that year, Jones and Archie I. James travel to Guyana to scout for locations. By the summer of 1974, land is purchased, supplies are purchased. Jones stays behind to oversee the installation of the power grid, the clearance of the field so they can start setting them up for farming. He starts to oversee the initial construction for the dorms for the people who are going to come. And by December of 1974, so only a year after the decision is made, the first group of Jonestown settlers arrive in Guyana
Wow.
and they start to operate the commune that eventually is known as Jonestown. And the sign over Jonestown says, Jonestown, an agricultural. Hold on. Does it say?
She's referencing the book, guys.
Referencing my book because I know it's in here. I just saw it. People's Temple Agricultural Project.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Jones goes back to the US because he wants to continue to combat the negative press. And I think it's more to get more people to come with him. If he kind of can shut up the naysayers, then more people are going to come. He unfortunately, well, I guess not unfortunately, because he deserved it. He wasn't successful, largely unsuccessful. And even more stories about abuse within the People's Temple start to come, public knowledge.
Right.
In March 1977, a man named Marshall Kilduff publishes a story in a magazine called New West Magazine, exposing some of the abuses within the People's Temple. Marshall alleges that there are physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, and years worth of evidence by himself and other defectors of the People's Temple to prove it. this is kind of like the last straw for Jim Jones. He's like, all right, it is time. We're all going because it's getting real. It's getting real over here and no bueno.
Yeah.
So he begins to work on convincing as many members as he possibly can to come with him to Guyana. He promoted it as this paradise of socialism. They're going to live off the land. They're going to give of one another. It is a true sanctuary. They're away from all this media scrutiny. Nobody's going to bother us anymore. We can live how we want in the jungle of Guyana and no one is going to say boo about it. And he said that he wanted to create this like model communist community. He added that the temple made up, quote, the purest communists there are.
Okay.
Yeah. But once they get to Jonestown, he doesn't let them leave. So like, it's not exactly like a utopia if you're not allowed to leave, right?
No.
It's a prison if you're not allowed to leave.
Yes.
Yeah. At the beginning of 1977, there's about 50 temple members in the commune, but it's really not ready yet to handle a big group of people to come in. Archie I. James warns Jones that the buildings that are on the property, which are already falling into disrepair, there are weeds within the fields. They are not able to grow anything in this jungle atmosphere. And he tells Archie I. James tells Jim Jones, he's like, maybe 200 people. But because of his need to relocate, feeling that it's urgent, Jones is able to bring over in May 9th of 1977 about 600 of his followers.
Holy shit.
And then about 400 more followed in the following months.
Oh boy.
So by the end of 77, he had more than 1,000 people living in a place where Archie I. James claimed could really only support 200 people.
Good Lord.
Yeah. He also not only is moving people, he's also moving the financial assets of the People's Temple overseas because he wants to really disassociate himself completely from the United States. He sells the property that they own in the U.S. They, at the time, they had over $10 million in assets in 1977.
Are you fucking kidding?
I am not. And in the, this I got from Wikipedia, this clip, and in 2020, that would have been worth over $42 million.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Even though Jones had like a shit ton of negative press back in the United States, he was actually still pretty well respected outside of the temple, specifically for the racial integration movement that he was able to promote. And 68% of the residents of Jonestown were Black.
Okay.
For the first couple of months, the temple members would work 6 days a week. They worked from about 6:30 in the morning to 6 o'clock at night. They had an hour for lunch. The work week was shortened to 8 hours a day for 5 days a week. In 1978, Jones's health started to not do so good in mid 1978. And Marceline started to take over a lot more of like the daily overseeing of the commune. Mm-hmm. And she shortened the work day. And after the day's work ended, temple members would go to the pavilion, the main pavilion in the commune, and spend several hours doing activities. They would take classes in socialism. Jim Jones compared the schedule that he created to the North Korean system of 8 hours of daily work followed by 8 hours of study.
Okay.
This combined with the temple's practice of subjecting its followers to mind control and behavior modification tactics.
Oh.
Again,
mm-hmm.
cult characteristics, mm-hmm. right? So keep members tired, separate from loved ones, brainwashing. I mean, like truly the pillars of cultism.
Yes.
There was also food deprivation
yep.
tactics beginning as well. In June 1978, Deborah Layton, who was a People's Temple member who wound up escaping from Jonestown 6 months before the massacre, she wound up signing an affidavit that detailed the many crimes by the temple and specifically the living conditions at Jonestown.
Oh boy.
In the affidavit, she stated that Jonestown residents were deliberately being undernourished.
Oh.
She said, quote, There was rice for breakfast, rice water soup for lunch, and rice and beans for dinner. On Sunday, we each received an egg and a cookie.
What?
Two or three times a week, we had vegetables. Some very weak and elderly members received one egg per day.
Wow.
Now, the whole idea of this being like an agricultural commune was moot because Jonestown was in a fucking jungle with really shitty soil.
Yep.
So they weren't able to grow anything. So nope. Most of the things that they did have, they had to import. So like anything that they were, there was nothing that they were creating. They were just living there in this terrible condition.
Mm-hmm.
Layton also notes in her affidavit that he did not, that Jones, of course, shocker among shockers, was not on the same diet as his followers.
No way.
I know. Now, he, of course, claims that he had blood sugar issues. So sure, he was able to eat meat and had substantial meals. And then if he had specific like members within his inner circle that he was like in favor with at the time, they were able to share in his food stores.
Of course.
And of course, these are the people. Of course, these are the people in the commune that seem to be the most healthy because they were the ones who were actually eating. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Jones would often read news and commentary to the followers during those study times in the pavilion in the evenings. He would read off news from Radio Moscow, Radio Havana. He was also known to side with the Soviets over the Chinese when there was a split between the two communist nations. Jones' news readings usually portrayed U.S. as a, quote, capitalist and imperialist villain, while casting socialist leaders such as Kim Il-sung, Robert Mugabe, and Joseph Mugabe, and Joseph Stalin in a positive light. So like, yay, communist leaders, boo, U.S. government.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. He would record the sessions in the pavilion, and the recordings that were reviewed after Jonestown show that he would get like real pissed and real frustrated if the people in the commune weren't finding what he was talking about interesting.
Seriously?
Or if they would like disagree or not understand what he was talking about. Yeah, he would get like real mad about it. So,
wow.
Among the followers in Guyana was a boy named John Victor Stowen. So John's birth certificate listed a man named Timothy Stowen and Grace Stowen as his parents. Jones had had a affair with Grace. And he claimed he was the biological father of John. But of course, like I said, Tim and Grace were both the ones on the birth certificate.
Right.
Grace defected in 1976. Tim did not yet. And she left her child behind with Tim. She fled. She bounced. Jones ordered Tim and the child to be taken to Guyana. And this was supposedly in order for Tim to be able to avoid a custody dispute with Grace back in California.
Okay.
But not long after, Timothy Stowen winds up leaving the People's Temple in June of 1977. Jones keeps the baby or keeps the child. So John Victor Stowen winds up staying behind with Jim Jones.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. In the fall of 1977, Timothy Stowen and other temple defectors start to form this group. They called it the Concerned Relatives because they, of course, have people behind in Jonestown. They're not being permitted to come back to the United States. They're barely permitted to even have contact with anybody in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Any contact that's being sent back or like letters. And they're, of course, like, you know, forced flowery language of how wonderful things are back in Jonestown. So Stowen winds up going to Washington, D.C. This is January of 1978. He visits with the State Department and he begs them basically to do something about the People's Temple. And he's giving many listings of grievances against the temple, specifically to get his son back. But
yes,
in general, just because of like how fucked up the whole thing is. In this session in Washington, D.C., he winds up getting the ear of a California congressman named Leo Ryan. Leo Ryan writes a letter on Tim Stowen's behalf to the Guyanese prime minister, a man named Forbes Burnham. The Concerned Relatives group start to sue the temple for custody of John Stone.
Mm-hmm.
So now, last week, the other asterisk I told you to mark in your head was the psychologically abusive tactics that Jones would play on Marceline when they were first married.
Correct.
That he would test her love and loyalty by claiming that one of her family members was dead. He would comfort her and then, oh, surprise, they're alive.
They're alive. Yay.
He started to play similar sadistic games with the followers that were living at the commune. So he was convinced that a raid on the commune was imminent, that the government was going to come, and that the commune wasn't going to be able to resist any attack brought upon them by the government. So he started to hold drills to test how ready they were to overcome these attacks. He called the drills White Knight drills. Mm. Okay. And at all hours of the day or night, he would get on the loudspeakers that were all over the commune and call alert, alert, alert. And that was the signifier for the community to come to the center pavilion. While they were all gathered in the pavilion, his armed guards with guns, crossbows, they would surround the pavilion and keep the people in the space.
Jesus.
They had to stay in the pavilion throughout the entire drill. While they're in the pavilion, he would tell them about there's an attack. There are people surrounding Jonestown. There are agents who are going to destroy us. He would lead them in prayers. He would have them sing and chant and yell at these supposed attackers that were in the jungle. He would sometimes have his guards post themselves in the forest and shoot their firearms so it would sound like there was people coming to attack them.
No.
Yes. And people were so afraid and petrified, but they wouldn't know that this was a drill until it was over. And he would tell them, this was a drill. You are now prepared. We are now ready. This is a drill. We're now ready. He actually had a drill in September of 1977 that lasted for 6 days.
But
yeah, it started to be known as the 6 day siege. And in this, he used this 6 day siege as a symbol of their resilience as a community.
Fuck that, dude.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
Now, of course, what did these drills do? They kept people afraid to leave because they thought that there were soldiers in those woods waiting to attack them.
Yep.
So they wouldn't sneak off and leave. In a White Knight drill in 1978, he tells his followers that he's going to distribute poison for everyone to drink because it is time for them to commit a ritualistic suicide. Mm. So a batch of punch was served to every single person in the pavilion who sat crying and waiting to die. They all took the poison and then just sat there, or all drank the fruit punch and then sat there waiting to die. Time goes by. Finally, he's like, that was a drill. There's no poison. And again, this was to get them prepared for what he called a revolutionary suicide. Okay.
This guy's a sick, twisted motherfucker.
Legit. Now, through these drills, he's convincing his followers that, again, the CIA is actively working to destroy us. And he's conditioning them to accept that suicide is the only way that they're going to be able to escape persecution by the government. On at least two different occasions, he would like hold a vote, and people would vote to commit revolutionary suicide because, again, he was able to convince them that this was the only way out. On at least two different occasions during these drills, after the vote was reached that revolutionary suicide would happen, he would simulate the drinking of the punch, saying that this was the time, and then coming clean that it was actually a drill. A defector by the name of Deborah Layton describes in an affidavit of the White Knights. She said, quote, everyone, including the children, were told to line up. As we passed through the line, we were given a small glass of red liquid to drink. We were told that the liquid contained poison and that we would die within 45 minutes. We all did as we were told. When the time came, we should have dropped dead. Reverend Jones explained that the poison was not real and that we had just been through a loyalty test. He warned us that the time was not far off when it would become necessary for us to die by our own hands. End quote.
What? kind of fucking point?
Yeah.
That's a terrible, terrible way to go. Like, you really want to sit there for 45 minutes feeling your body being overcome with poison? Like, seriously? That's terrible. But, anyway.
Yeah. So 1978 was a real shit show for Jonestown.
Yeah.
Community was, they were exhausted. They were overworked. They were psychologically tortured by this man. The loudspeakers that he used to call the White Knights, he would also now broadcast sermons that he would play on a loop constantly for people to have to listen to. He began to claim this belief that he called it translation. And he said that once the settlers of Jonestown did commit this revolutionary suicide, that they would all live blissfully together in the afterlife.
I wouldn't want to at that point.
Mm-hmm. According to Terry Buford O'Shea, one of the few escapees from Jonestown, she said that sleep deprivation was one of the most effective methods of controlling the followers. She said, quote, "One time Jim said to me, let's keep them poor and tired, because if they're poor, they can't escape. And if they're tired, they can't make plans."
Mm-hmm.
End quote. O'Shea also reported that he would maintain his control over the members by using different types of punishment. One such punishment was he would keep them in a coffin-shaped box several feet underground while other members were made to yell at them, berate them, reprimand them for these things that he would make up that they did against the community.
I don't even know what to say to that. I don't even know what the fuck to say to that.
Yeah. All the while, it is reported that Jones was at the time abusing multiple different types of drugs. He was taking Valium, Quaaludes, stimulants, and barbiturates. And the audio recordings that were recovered kind of like back that up, because he was so erratic and the things that he was saying obviously like wasn't really making sense. Mm-hmm. And through these audio recordings, he would start to like complain about the ailments that he was going through. He was talking about high blood pressure. He said that he was having small strokes. He was losing a lot of weight. He was experiencing temporary blindness, even convulsion, swelling of his limbs. So like he was like even complaining about the fact that he was like physically falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
So we're about to get to like the climax, but I just want to say, I have a really weird feeling, and not saying that it wouldn't have happened eventually anyway, but there's a part of me that feels that I don't know if he would have went through with the revolutionary suicide as quickly as he did if he himself wasn't like, obviously, I mean, kind of like actively dying.
Yes. No, I agree, because I guarantee he was like, well, I'm going to die. So
I'm taking you all with me.
Correct. I got to do one big last hurrah kind of a thing. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Uh-huh. And like I said, not saying that he probably wouldn't have. I was so fucking paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a part of me that wonders how long they would have held out without it.
Correct.
Without him being that sick. Okay. We are in November of 1978. 45 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Congressman Ryan, who we earlier met, when the defector Timothy Stone went to Washington, D.C., he decides he's going to lead a fact-finding mission to Jonestown to, I guess, corroborate the claims that were being made by Tim Stone. He pulls together a delegation that included relatives of Temple members. He had an NBC camera crew, and he had reporters from other newspapers, and of course, like his own aides, etc.
Mm-hmm.
The group arrives in the Guyanese capital of Georgetown on November 15th. 2 days later, they travel by airplane to Port Kaituma, and then were transported to Jonestown itself.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Jones hosts a reception for the outsiders, and they're, of course, all in the central pavilion. He's having the temple members put on a real good show. They're singing. They're telling the delegation how much they love being there. But as he's making his rounds, Congressman Ryan gets passed a note through the reporter that's there, the NBC reporter that's there, Don Harris, requesting assistance for himself and another temple member to leave.
Oh, shit. Like,
get me the fuck out of here, basically. Mm-hmm. tensions start to grow. It's like starts to kind of get like palpable within the pavilion, because as this happens, more and more people are asking
to go
for Congressman Ryan to take them with him.
Mm-hmm.
The afternoon of November 18th, Congressman Ryan is like, we got to get the hell out of here, because a temple member, Don Sly, attempts to stab him. He's like, let's get the fuck out of here, because we got to go. The delegation that he brought with him, they're able to take along 15 temple members that decide that it's time to defect. Jones makes no effort to prevent them from leaving, lets them go.
Which is weird, right?
Weird.
Yeah.
I would say that if I was in part of that delegation, I would say maybe he just doesn't want to make a scene in front of reporters. True. Right. So he's going to let us go.
Mm-hmm.
As members of the delegation and the defectors board two different planes that are at Port Kaituma airstrip, Jonestown's Red Brigade of armed guards start to shoot at them.
Mm-hmm. There it
the
is.
Gunmen. Yep. The gunmen kill Congressman Ryan and four other people near a Guyana Airways Twin Otter aircraft. At the same time, one of the supposed defectors, a man named Larry Layton, draws a weapon and begins firing on members of the party inside the other plane.
Stop it.
Yeah. When they were in the, this is part of the story from one of the people in the delegation that I was telling you about, one of the articles I read. They were in the back of the bed of a pickup truck with Larry Layton as they were heading towards the airstrip. And one of the members kind of leaned over and said to this person, he's too close to Jim Jones to be defecting, and I think he has a gun. We need to watch out for him.
Oh shit.
But they couldn't tell that it was raining. So he had like a poncho over him. So they couldn't see that he had a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that he indeed was like kind of planted himself in there to try and take out as many people as he could from the delegation in loyalty to Jones.
No, not worth it. Sorry.
Yeah.
Not fucking worth it.
NBC cameraman Bob Brown was able to capture footage of the first few seconds of the shooting before he himself was killed.
Oh, wow.
I've seen that footage. It's insane.
Oh,
really,
wow.
It's really upsetting. The five killed at the airstrip were Congressman Leo Ryan, NBC reporter Don Harris, the man who was passed the note in the pavilion, NBC cameraman Bob Brown, San Francisco Examiner photographer Greg Robinson, and Temple member Patricia Parks. Surviving the attack was future Congresswoman Jackie Spear, Jackie Spear. She was at the time a staff member of Leo Ryan. Richard Dwyer, who was the deputy chief of mission from the U.S. Embassy in Georgetown.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Flick, an NBC producer. Steve Sung, an NBC sound engineer. Tim Reiterman, an Examiner reporter, who eventually goes on to be a biographer of Jim Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Javers, a Chronicle reporter. Charles Krause, a Washington Post reporter. And then, of course, several defecting Temple members.
Mm-hmm.
They wound up running into the jungle to avoid being killed.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. Like, you know, that says something when they'd rather risk their lives by running into the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Agree.
Instead of being like, oh, just kidding, we're sorry, let us back in. You know what I mean? Like,
uh-huh.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yep. As the attack at the airstrip is happening, back at the settlement, aides of Jones start to mix the poison flavorade. So they prepare a large metal tub with grape flavorade poisoned with, and I've wrote out the name of the names of the drugs, and I'm going to try and say them all.
Okay. Let's, you could do it. I have faith. Okay.
Poisoned with diphenhydramine, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Promethazine,
mm-hmm.
Promethazine. Okay.
Sure.
Chlorpromazine.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Chloroquine.
Mm-hmm.
No, no, no. Chloral hydrate.
Mm-hmm.
Diazepam.
Okay.
And cyanide.
Jeez. What a cocktail, huh?
Yeah. So the reason why they had cyanide in the first place, Jim Jones got himself certified as like a official jeweler, because cyanide is used to clean gold And that's how he was able to legally import cyanide to the Jonestown settlement. He got himself certified as a jeweler.
Of course he did. Of course he did.
Yeah. So later that afternoon, once Jones gets word that the security guards did not kill everybody who was part of Leo Ryan's delegation, he concludes in his puny little brain that, well, they're going to go and they're going to inform the U.S. government, and it is only a matter of time before we are all rounded up and like arrested, killed, mm-hmm. whatever. So he calls a drill. Everybody comes to the central pavilion and he informs the community. Leo Ryan is dead, and it's only a matter of time before military commandos descend on Jonestown and kill them all. He tells the temple members that he has tried, but the Soviet Union would not give them safe passage after what happened at the airstrip. He said, quote, "We can check with Russia to see if they'll take us immediately. Otherwise, we die. You think Russia's going to want us with all this stigma?"
Wow.
Jones and several senior members argue that the group should indeed go through with their revolutionary suicide. He recorded the entire thing on audio.
No.
And you can listen to the entire thing on Wikipedia.
No, I'm good.
And it is incredibly fucking upsetting.
No, I'm good. I am good.
You watch documentaries, they will play clips of it. It is upsetting. One temple member, a woman named Christine Miller, argues at the beginning against revolutionary suicide. You can hear her yelling it out at the beginning of the tape. You can hear cries and screams from both children and adults. The poison flavor aid starts to get handed out. Those who refused to drink were injected directly with cyanide. They, of course, were also surrounded by those armed guards, basically giving them the choice. I either take the poison or I get killed by the guards. A woman named Ruletta Paul and her one-year-old child were the first to take the poison. It was directed that the children should take the poison first, followed by the adults. According to an escaped temple member named Odell Rhodes, after ingesting the poison, the people were taken down a wooden walkway that led them outside of the pavilion. They would just sit and wait to die.
Die.
As parents watched their kids perish, mm-hmm. it was just complete panic, complete confusion. He added that many of the members, quote, walked around as if they were in a trance, and that the majority just quietly waited their own turn to die.
Oh, God.
Over time, as more temple members are passing away, the guards themselves are now called over for them to take the poison, and they do. It's not clear if at first some people thought it was a white knight trick trial, mm-hmm. but obviously it didn't take long for them to know it was the real thing. Mm-hmm. There was weeping, crying, screaming on the audio tape. And when people were calling out or saying that they were refusing, Jones would speak up and say, quote, "Stop these hysterics. This is not the way for people who are socialists or communists to die. No way for us to die. We must die with some dignity. Don't be afraid to die. We are just stepping over into another plane." And he added that death is a friend. At the end of the tape, he states, quote, "We didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide, protesting the conditions of an inhumane world."
Wow.
In the early evening of November 18th, a temple member named Sharon Amos, she was living at the headquarters in Georgetown, so outside of Jonestown itself, mm-hmm. in the capital of Guyana. Mm-hmm. She gets a radio message from Jonestown telling them that they're committing their revolutionary suicide, and it is their turn now to commit their...
Oh, no.
It is time for them to do it. So... police wind up arriving at the headquarters, and after they were there, Sharon goes into the bathroom with her three children, and she kills two of them first. Her oldest child then helps her kill herself, and then the oldest child kills herself.
Good God!
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. In all, The events resulted in the deaths of 909 inhabitants of Jonestown, 276 of which were children.
Oh my God.
Yeah. This event results in the greatest single loss of American civilian life in a deliberate act until the attacks of September 11th.
That is fucking terrible. Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody realizes how many people actually died.
I don't think so either. I don't think I realized how many people died.
It was just short of 1,000 people. Obviously, the other four members who were in Georgetown also perished. The FBI later recovers the 45-minute audio recording, and it is soon known as the death tape.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. There are 85 members from the settlement that survived the event. So some of them run into the jungle just as everything begins at the pavilion.
Mm-hmm.
One man hides in a ditch.
Mm-hmm.
There's one woman. She's an elderly woman. She slept through the entire thing.
That would be me.
I mean, same.
Honestly. Yeah.
Truly. But of course, then you're faced with the trauma of waking up and finding everybody that you know and love dead.
This is true. This is
so
true.
It's
yeah.
like, yeah, not, not the best.
Mm-hmm.
Three high-ranking temple members were given an assignment to transfer funds to the Soviet embassy, and they were able to escape death because they were on that assignment while this was all going down.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jonestown basketball team was at an away game.
Stop it. Mm-hmm. There was a fucking basketball team?
Mm-hmm.
No, there was not.
Because like for years they were living there, they like integrated themselves into the community.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So Jones had three sons who were all on the basketball team, Stephen, Jim Jr., and Tim Jones. So they, of course, were able to escape the event.
Mm-hmm.
During the events at Jonestown, the brothers drove to the U.S. Embassy in Georgetown to alert the authorities.
Okay.
Guyanese soldiers who were guarding the embassy wouldn't let them in because they heard about what happened at the airstrip and were concerned that they were coming to attack.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. That makes sense. Yeah.
But later they were able to return back to headquarters. And when they got there, they found the bodies of Sharon and her three children.
Oh, yeah.
The Guyanese military arrive in Jonestown and find the bodies. The U.S. military organizes an airlift to bring the remains back to the United States to be buried. Jones was found dead on the stage of the Central Pavilion, resting on a pillow near his deck chair with a gunshot wound to the head. The Soviet Union publicly denounces Jones, and they called his bastardization, this event, as a bastardization of the concept of revolutionary suicide, which, like, I don't know if I would be like defending the revolutionary suicide per se, but like they were like, he does not speak for us. This guy's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is echoed by American Christian leaders. So they, of course, say that he is not a religious leader, but is indeed satanic. They assert that he and his teachings were in no way connected to traditional Christianity. Mm-hmm. The Disciples of Christ, who they were part of that denomination, they take this as a hint to kind of change the way that they ordain their ministers. Because like I said before, there was like no rules. They were just like, hey, you get to be minister. So they actually not only had changes on how they choose ministers, but they also were able to like remove people too.
Mm-hmm.
The Disciples of Christ issue a press release disavowing Jones and then completely like excommunicated Jonestown from the denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And the People's Temple as a whole, because of course there were still locations in the U.S. Investigations into the Jonestown massacre were conducted by the FBI and by the U.S. Congress. Now, even though there was, like we said earlier, reports of abuse within the temple given to the FBI, there was never any investigation or any like official investigation. And a lot of this FBI investigation that happened after the fact was really focused on the authorities as to why we weren't investigating anything. And although the People's Temple collapsed shortly after the events in 1978, some individuals continued to follow Jones's teaching throughout the 80s.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Decades later, survivors of Jonestown remember that the good parts of being part of the People's Temple. which a lot of it was the people. So, yeah. Quote, the people were incredible. People who were capable of committing themselves to something outside of their own self-interest. That's a quote by Jean Clancy, who worked at the Temple newspaper. Adds Laura Johnston Cole, another former Temple member, quote, we, all of us, were doing the right things, but in the wrong place with the wrong leader.
Yeah.
Since the massacre at Jonestown, there's countless resources, you know, documentaries, literature, books, films, you name it, about Jonestown. Jim Jones and Jonestown kind of defined society's idea of what a cult is.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not the first cult, but it's probably the most synonymous with cult, right? I mean, it's the cult, right?
Yeah, because usually when you start talking about cults, it's usually Jonestown or Heaven's Gate. Or Manson. Yeah, it's those three. Those are the big ones.
And as we know, the widely known expression, drinking the Kool-Aid, right? Or he drank Kool-Aid, comes from the events at Jonestown, even though we know they actually use slavery aid. Mm-hmm. And that's actually how we got on that conversation at work a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah?
It was somebody said, don't drink the Kool-Aid. And I was like, well, you know, they actually use Flavor Aid. And then we got onto the subject of Jonestown. And that inspired me to tell the story that I am now finally done telling. That, my friends, is the story of Jim Jones, the People's Temple, and the tragedy of Jonestown 45 years ago.
Damn. Just damn. Like, obviously, I knew about Jonestown and like the very basics of it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know a lot of that, so thank you. But
it's crazy, fuck, right?
Dude, that's nuts. Mm-hmm. That is just nuts. And it's so sad.
It is incredibly
so
sad.
So sad. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I definitely would have been that old lady sleeping.
Same. I probably would have thrown my ass in a ditch.
Well, that, or I would have pretended to drink the Kool-Aid and just like kind of threw myself to the ground.
Exactly.
And then be like, okay. Yeah. And then in my head, I'd be like, I think I drank it around the same time they did. Oh, they're dying. Oh, you know, it'd be one of those types of things. I would not. No, absolutely fucking not.
Mm-hmm.
I just, so sad.
It's horrifying.
So sad. It really is. It's so scary. So scary.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And like watching these people that you know, your neighbors, people you love, people you've worked with side by side with for all these years, watching them do it, knowing that it's about to happen to you.
Yeah.
Horrifying. Absolutely horrifying.
And that makes it so much worse.
Mm-hmm.
So much worse.
Mm-hmm. His one son wound up going back to California, not one of the ones that was in the basketball team, one of the other sons wound up going back to California and kind of trying to take over the church or reinvigorate the church in California, and was trying to claim that none of what happened at Jonestown actually happened, and that it was a conspiracy by the government to like defame them. And then eventually came forward and was like, yeah, it happened.
Mm-hmm. You kind of can't deny it when there's like audio proof and like a video proof of that like first couple of seconds or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it kind of fucking happened, dude. Sorry. Yeah. There's no denying it at that point. Well, Charlie, that was totally worth the wait.
I finally did it.
Totally worth the wait. But now we have to challenge you to another cult. So as much as I would love to throw Nexium at you, I know that's too much.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
And that's one that I would love to do, but that is a lot.
Maybe we should do that for our 200th episode.
Ooh, maybe. We could tackle that together.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like we did with Ted Bundy. I don't know. We'll see. But we need more cult stories from you because, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Charlie.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Well done. That was very, very good. I enjoyed that. Now I want to watch all the documentaries on Jonestown.
Everything about Jonestown.
All the things about Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guys, I hope that you guys are having a good Thanksgiving if you're listening on release day. If there happens to be Flavor Aid at your house, I'm pretty sure it's not laced with any poison, so you're
good. Should
yeah,
be good.
Should be good. However, if you think that it might, you could always email us to tell us how you feel about it, or you could just tell us about how your holiday went. We love to hear some good stories. If there was something funny that happened or something embarrassing, like fun family stories, like please share with us. We want to be part of your family. It'll be fun. And maybe we'll share some fun. No, we won't. You can email us at bedcrimestoriespod@gmail.com. You can also slide up into our DMs on the Instagram at bedcrimestories. Wherever you are listening, please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe.
Please, please, please.
Also, this Thanksgiving, we're very thankful if you tell a friend.
We're thankful for you and telling a friend.
We're very thankful for you and for you telling a friend. Please, besides not drinking the Flavorade and following people like Jim Jones, please be kind.
Please be the Band-Aid.
Yes, very, very important. But yeah, I think that's it.
I think that's it.
Yeah. So whenever you are listening, I hope you're having a good day, good night, good turkey day, whenever. We will see you guys next week. But until then,
sweet dreams. Our theme song is the song Industrial Music Box by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0.